Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
All right. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm very excited to be here. I hope you are as well. Commonwealth Club, it's the place where you're in the know, and you can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And I'm Robert Sutton. I'm a professor of management science and engineering from Stanford, and I'm the moderator for today's program. And as you know, it's my pleasure to introduce today's guest. It's Jeffrey Lundberg. He's a professor of linguistics, actually, at the UC Berkeley School of Information, which is a great and fascinating place. And he's author of this great book. This is actually an advanced copy. It looks a little bit different out front. I hope you'll buy one. It's called Ascent of the A-Word. And I'm supposed to say, for our radio audience, A-holism, the first 60 years. That's what it's about. And let me just take a minute to introduce him and describe the book and to get on with it. So I think some of you know, I also wrote a book on a similar topic on sort of workplace jerks that also starts with the A word. And so for better or worse, I am deluged with every book that's vaguely related to this topic. And so I've read a lot of them in the last 4 or 5 years. And so I've actually read this book in the twice in the last month, both in this form, and then I also ordered it on Amazon and read it again. And I sort of had to squelch my inner jerk to admit this in that sort of narcissistic, selfish part. But really, this is the best book I've ever read on the topic. So I really encourage you to read it. So it took me a while to admit that to myself, but it's true. And just to sort of warm you up, and in classic form, I lost my place. There it is. I just want to read you a couple of sentences, and then I think Jeff should get on with it because we all want to hear from him. And I've got to censor myself carefully here. And so this is the end of the introduction. So if a-hole weren't crude, so that's censored, of course, we'd have to find something else to call the guy who's yelling at the harassed airport agent about his upgrade. So if I dance around in the word in the title of this book, you could think of it as an homage to its power. Considering all it does for us and to us, a-hole doesn't get nearly the respect it deserves. Classic sort of beautiful language. And without further ado, Jeff, I think you're on.
Thanks so much, Bob. This is my maiden effort, the first time I've spoken about this book, so things may be a little disorganized. I think of the story about the Scotsman who found himself in the 18th century in a bookseller's shop in Edinburgh and saw a copy of Johnson's Dictionary and picked it up and says, "Yon book is interesting but frightfully disconnected." So that may be the status of this talk. I'm also really glad that Bob Sutton is here and has done the honors and will be afterwards answering questions, I hope, and talking as well about his book. I'm a huge admirer of his book. In particular, Bob has had to deal, as I have, with this singular problem of writing a book about a topic whose name can't be pronounced in lots of venues. Nowadays there's any number of books whose titles exploit a kind of prurient interest in this language. There's, you know, S-word, my dad says, and go the F-word to sleep, and if you give a kid a cookie, will he shut the F-word up, and so on. And there's an appeal, a kind of naughty appeal to using words like these. It's, after all, what our parents called a bad word, and I don't know if there's really a better description of it than a bad word. Some find it deeply offensive. And I respect it. I don't know anybody actually who finds it deeply offensive, but then I probably live in the wrong zip code. Others, and I do know many people like this, find it coarse and crude. I know people who would prefer not to say the word, not because they're shocked, but because they find it crude. And as Bob mentioned, I make the point that if it weren't coarse and crude, it wouldn't do the work it does for us. There are times when you're not only allowed to say the word, you're obliged to say the word. A friend calls you up to tell you that She's just discovered her husband is having an affair with the au pair and that they're about to elope to the Bahamas. And what do you say? You're obliged to say, you don't say, what a cad, what a bounder. No, you're obliged to say what an a-hole this person is. And if you don't say it, you failed in your responsibilities to your friend. It's also the case how often you can say these words and whether you're permitted to say these words depends, obviously, on where you are and on the context. It depends whether you're on where you are on the TV dial, whether you're on broadcast cable, broadcast TV, or free cable, or pay cable, according to which they won't let you say the word. They'll bleep the word, or they'll just let you say it. It depends on the context. The New York Times, until recently, had never used the word. Never printed the word, not even when George W. Bush was overheard on open mic during the 2000 campaign using the word of the Times reporter Adam Clymer. Big story. The Times reported merely that he called Clymer an obscenity, which makes it sound a lot worse than it was, actually. They did use it recently, actually, in transcribing the George Zimmerman 911 tapes in which he used the word of Trayvon Martin. I think the feeling was, well, it's important what word he used, that we can't just say an obscenity here. So in this discussion, I'm not going to say the word. I will sometimes say a word and occasionally a hole. Though a hole seems to me even more vulgar. It's like what my Aunt Estelle would say. You know, I don't. And sometimes I'll say, as Bob does, jerk, which comes pretty close, though they're different. A jerk can have an affectionate tone. There's a wonderful moment in, anybody recall it, I know you're not going to recall it, but Ball of Fire, the 1941 Howard Hawks film with Barbara Stanwyck and Gary Cooper. And Barbara Stanwyck says of Gary Cooper, "I love him because he doesn't know how to kiss the big jerk." Now, you can be sure that even if the A word had been around back then, it wouldn't have been appropriate in that context. In fact, it's hard to imagine any context in which one could apply the A word to any character played by Gary Cooper. I mean, it's Gary Cooper. So why talk about the word at all? Why are you writing a book about this? Or why did you write this book? It's a question I hear a lot, and I'm sure Bob heard it as well. And when you tell her, what are you working on, academics would say to me, and I'd say, well, I'm working a book on the A word. And I'd get one of two reactions. They'd either laugh, or they'd say, boy, you must have a lot of time on your hands, or both. If you get that reaction and you can get past it, it actually tells you you're on to something. Because from a linguist's point of view, words like the A word and vulgar language in general tend to fly under the radar of consciousness. They seem so ordinary and not worth talking about that we don't really give them much thought. And for that reason, they're going to be much more accurate windows on our attitudes than the words about which we pontificate dilate on the op-ed pages. Take one of the words that got me going on this whole project, civility or incivility. It's not an English word, really. I mean, nobody learned the word incivility at the dinner table from his or her parents. It's a word you learned from op-ed pages, and it's a word that triggers this whole long narrative of the coarsening of American culture and cultural decay and so on and so forth. It's not the word in which we ordinarily frame our thoughts about the things that we then talk about using incivility. Let me try a little experiment here, and I don't know if this is going to work, but I want to tell you a story. A man I know from Texas found himself on 9/11 in Manhattan. Wanted to get home, obviously, to Texas. The flights were closed. I think for a while, actually, the trains weren't working either. He went to a bunch of ATMs, got all the cash he could, and went over to the Hertz rental place on West 43rd Street. He walks in there. Needless to say, there's this vast crowd of people all desperate to get home to their families, or their families desperate to get home to trying to rent cars and so on. The clerks are trying to deal with it. And this little guy comes in, and he kind of pushes to the front of the line, and he says to the clerks in a very loud voice, "Excuse me, where is the gold card line?" Now, I think probably from those reactions that we all have exactly the same thought. I can't look into your minds, but my guess is that you're thinking the same word, right? And that word is not incivility, right? You're thinking what an a-hole. And I think the point of that is that this word embodies a very specific idea about the obligations we owe to each other when we're dealing with each other in everyday life, on the highway, in the Hertz rental place, on airplane, in the office, in relationships, and in the workplace, as Bob has written about. And if you want to understand those attitudes, it helps to focus on the words that express them, and particularly the words to which nobody ever gives any thought, because if you ask people about incivility, they'll get on a high horse and tell you all sorts of things that don't really reflect what's going on with them. So I'm interested in the word and the concept it expresses. And in this sense, although Bob and I have the same problem of how to talk about this without actually often using the word, we're different. He's interested in these people. And in a very broad way, interested in these people in the workplace. He writes, you might call such people bullies, creeps, jerks, weasels, tormentors, tyrants, serial slammers, despots, or unconstrained egomaniacs, but for me at least, the A word best captures the fear and loathing that I have for these nasty people. So he's casting his net very generally, and that seems to me the appropriate way to do it, because you're interested in this large class of unpleasant, difficult people. On the other hand, I'm interested not in the people as such, but in the concept and the word and what it says about us. I think a couple of points worth making. First, this word has a fascination. If this is an age of a-holes, it's not probably because there are more of them walking around than there ever were. You know, you read Dickens or Trollope, and you look at the massive number of scoundrels and cads and so on running around. It's hard to argue that people have become worse in their behavior to each other than they were back then. But we certainly are fascinated by the a-hole. I looked last year at Barbara Walters. Excuse me, let's take a sip here. 10 most fascinating people, the list she comes out with every year. At the top of the list was Steve Jobs, the first time that she'd ever made a posthumous selection. And it also included Donald Trump, Simon Cowell, Herman Cain, and the Kardashians. That's five who would certainly get the A-word label from lots of people anyway. It also included Derek Jeter, Katy Perry, Amanda Knox, Pippa Middleton, and the actors who play the two gay guys on The Modern Family. Now, Jeter, some people would assign him that label as well. There are all these stories about him sending his dates home in cabs with a bag of autographed gear. But, you know, I mean, if you're going to start throwing the A-word around at people in a Yankee infield that includes Alex Rodriguez, I don't know if you want to start with Jeter. So I'll give him a break and say there's just five on that. Listen, if you look back at earlier years, this isn't an odd one. That ratio, 4-6, is about right. I mean, she's got Tiger Woods, James Cameron, Karl Rove, Glenn Beck, Mel Gibson, Curt Schilling, Dennis Rodman. There's a disproportionate number of people who qualify for this label, even by the standards of the number of people in public life. It's not the case that half the people in public life qualify for this label, not nearly. So there's a kind of fascination with this category that's very much characteristic of our time. And in fact, every age picks a certain type of miscreant on whom it fastens its interest and attention. In the post-war years, and we've all read Catcher in the Rye, what was Holden Caulfield's obsession? The phony. Everybody in that period was talking about the phony. Kerouac and Ginsberg and the Beatniks and Holden Caulfield and so everybody was interested in the phony. In the age of Anthony Trollope, the late Victorian period, the cad. Everything was either about the cad or spoke explicitly about it. So each age has a characteristic miscreant, and ours is the a-hole. It shows up, for instance, in the forms of entertainment that are characteristic of our period. Reality TV. Donald Trump is God's own a-hole. I mean, he's a pure a-hole in a way in which few people are a pure anything. And he's an a-hole not just in his political activities, not just in his personal life, but he creates a television show in which the whole program is structured in order to enable him to say, you're fired, to be an a-hole, to other characters who have been encouraged to act like a-holes over the course of the program, because it's enormously gratifying to see someone behave like an a-hole to people who are a-holes. It's a principle that Trump understands better than anybody else in the world, except, of course, Stephen Colbert, who also understands it. It runs through reality programs from Real Family, Real Housewives to American Idol and so on. It's a 24/7 spectacle on cable television, political talk on cable television, and on, needless to say, on AM radio, political AM talk radio. people say, well, why can't we be civil to each other? And the answer is because nobody would watch. These people are selling soap, and a-holism, as I call it, sells lots of soap. So you say, well, yes, but isn't this just a reflection of our internal interest in the deeds, misdeeds of the high and the mighty? Is it really different from the broadsides and handbills and scabrous songs they were singing about Marie Antoinette in 18th century France and so on? And in a way, it isn't. I mean, we're always interested in as I say, the misdeeds of the high and mighty, but it's a bit different. For one thing, the a-hole is a very specific category. We tend to think of words like these vulgar words as almost not having a meaning, as just being the explosions of emotional steam that erupt from us as just pure expressions of feeling with no real meanings. Even the Oxford English Dictionary simply defines the word as someone contemptible, very vague kind of definition. It's not true. If you think about it, we use this word in very specific ways. You can get that label, the A-word label, for cutting into the left turn lane, but not for texting while you drive, for example. That might be reprehensible and contemptible. It's not. It doesn't make you an A-hole. If you can get the A-word label for cheating on your wife and girlfriend, or girlfriend, or both, I suppose, but not for cheating on an expense report or a final exam. That, again, may be reprehensible, but it doesn't make you an a-hole. If you take credit for a colleague's work, a-hole. If you plagiarize somebody else's book, terrible, but it doesn't make you an a-hole. If George Bush was an a-hole, and some people think he was, it wasn't because he lied about WMDs, if you think he did, but because of the way he smirked at the press. There's a very specific meaning to this word. And moreover, it's one that we apply only to a certain kind of people. The person has to be familiar to you, not necessarily a friend, but somebody you feel is like you. You would never use the A word, for example, to refer to Osama bin Laden. Too remote, too distant, too exotic. It has to be somebody of our own tribe, so to speak. So this vocabulary, along with the other words that come in with a-hole, carves up our moral life in very specific ways. Second of all, it's a new category. The A word is invented sometime during the Second World War by GIs. It's originally a word for a pretentious or officious officer or superior. The first appearance as a description of a character is in Norman Mailer's 1948 war novel, The Naked and the Dead. There's a minor character, a Lieutenant Dove, whom he introduces with this description of Proustian specificity. Lieutenant Dove, J.G., a Cornell man, a deke, and a perfect a-hole. That's the and then demonstrates why he's a perfect a-hole. The word's used in that period, and it's used in the 50s and 60s and so on, but it really doesn't enter the language until around 1970. The movement left in the 60s is using it. There's a famous incident when people shout the word at Nixon from the balcony at a speech he's giving in Illinois. But it really isn't a part of everyday English, the English that everybody uses. Or if we don't use it, because some people really don't use it, as I said in that example of the 911 example, we think it, which is pretty much the same thing. 1970, that's when you start to hear characters using it in Woody Allen movies and Neil Simon plays and essays by Tom Wolfe. It's when it starts to appear movies, cop movies like Dirty Harry. It plays a very significant role in almost each of the Dirty Harry movies. In comedies like Animal House and Caddyshack, There's always a character, Ted Knight in Caddyshack, both the dean of students and the president of the other fraternity in Animal House, who embody this particular type of character. In the same way that in the Dirty Harry movies, Eastwood uses it in both ways. He uses it for his officious, pretentious, ambitious superiors, and for the punks he's chasing. why does it happen then? Well, it's that moment, for one thing, that the styles of the 60s that were introduced in the 60s, which were thought to be very subversive in the 60s, are domesticated, made part of the ordinary apparatus of American life. Jeans were not acceptable, really, as ordinary. You wouldn't wear them to work or something in the 60s. By the 70s, everybody's wearing jeans. Long hair in the late 60s was threatening. You read the Wall Street Journal editorials from that period, and they talk these long-haired, filthy hippies. And by the 70s, you look at those yearbooks. We all, if you were around then, we all looked like that. drugs, again, dangerous in the 60s, ordinary in the 70s. Rock and roll, same thing. And swearing becomes very common in the 60s, not just about men, but among men, but among women. Using this kind of language. What it is a signal of authenticity, which becomes the dominant sensibility of that period. Rather than formality, you're informal, you're authentic. And how do you show you're authentic? You wear jeans, you swear. When Dick Cheney said to Senator Leahy on the Senate floor, go yourself, go F-word yourself, Krauthammer, Charles Krauthammer of the Washington Post, commended him for a demonstration of earthy authenticity. This works both ways. When a Republican or a conservative uses that word, he's commended by the right and the left. Oh, this is terrible, what happened to civility, and so on and so forth. When it's a Democrat who says it, as when Joe Biden whispered that remark into Obama's ear after the passage of the health care bill, all of a sudden, the Republic. This is terrible. What's happening to civility? And the Democrats are saying this is a demonstration of Biden's earthy honesty, and so on. But swearing becomes at that point a mark of authenticity, like jeans and the long hair, and so on. and the figure create in that period, we create the figure of the pretentious, self-deluding a-hole with this swollen sense of entitlement. The word drives out some of the older reproaches. Holden Caulfield's phonies, people stop talking about phony. We still use phonies in adjective, but people stop talking about phony as Holden did, certainly. Those people became a-holes. The heel, the classic movie heel, Dan Duryea, for example. Excuse me, I'm blocking out what's his name, the actor? It'll come to me. The classic movie heel is replaced by the a-hole. Feminists start this, but it becomes very general. And the difference isn't simply a difference of names. No, the heel has no inner life. We don't really care about it. He's just a heel. The a-hole is all of a sudden pathetic, out of touch with his feelings. somebody who has no sensitivity. So there's this shift in our idea of the category and why men mistreat women that's accompanied by a shift in vocabulary. I don't want to talk too long about this, and I'm summarizing a long argument. As I said, it's the first time through it. But there's one point I want to make, that the advent of this word has moral implications that are very important in this moment. To use a word like the A word of somebody is an uncivil thing to do. I mean, you're swearing at somebody. Somebody cuts me off on the highway and I say, you A word, right? I'm swearing at him. I'm being deliberately uncivil. And in the case of this word, I'm comparing him to a part of the body that's small and noisome and foul and stinky and so on and so forth. It's a terribly uncivil thing to do. And yet there are contexts in which we not only permit ourselves to do it, but we're obliged to do it. As, for example, when you get that call from your your friend who tells you about her husband running away. There's a principle here that I think of as the moral logic of aholism, that there are acts so uncivil, so contrary to the normal expectations that we have about how people should behave to one another, that they merit being responded to in an uncivil way with a name like a-hole. And that's a principle, whether this name word itself is used or not, that's a principle that has come to be very prevalent in our public life in particular. If you listen to the quality of public discourse and these complaints about incivility, there's a striking thing. People, historians say, oh, well, no, they were saying the same things about Roosevelt, they were saying the same things about Lincoln, they were saying the same things about Jackson, they were saying the same things about Jefferson and so on. It's true. By those standards, the tone of American political discourse is, I wouldn't say it's gentle, but it's not up to those standards. But it's a very different tone now. Things that we say to each other are unimaginable in those historical contexts. When, for example, Westbrook Pegler, the 30s and 40s columnist, said that Jews were geese, and so they hiss when they talk, and so on. He was giving voice in a very nasty way to a virulent, nasty anti-Semitism. When Ann Coulter makes a similar remark about Muslims, or when she says, for example, about the 9/11 wives, they enjoyed their husband's death. Now, it is, in a sense, as mean and nasty a remark, but she doesn't mean it. I mean, nobody really thinks that she has it in for these women. She's merely making a statement that will so outrage the a-holes on the other side that they'll become indignant, and she can then bond with her fellows on the right in the enjoyment of the indignation she's evoking in the other side. It's a kind of theater of a-holism. And in a certain sense, although the language is as nasty or sounds as nasty, it really plays a very different role. It's something I'm always struck by, and I'll conclude this, but when charges of incivility often have this quality. A charges B with incivility in political life. And you look at what B said, and yeah, it wasn't uncivil. B said they want to throw Social Security under the bus. Oh, well, they want to throw so-and-so under the bus. Oh, that's a violent metaphor. That's not a violent metaphor, throwing somebody under the bus. There was a story just the other day, I think. I don't have it. There was a similar story the other day, but Biden's remark about they want to put you in chains, oh, that's about slavery and so on. Everybody knew that wasn't what Biden was saying. And it doesn't matter. The point of it was that it gave people who were Biden's opponents the opportunity to play a certain kind of indignation at the a-hole on the other side. So these charges of incivility can themselves be one of the most virulent forms that a-holism takes in American public life. I'm going to sort of limp to a close at that point, and maybe we can pick some of this up in discussion. So, thank you.
Thank you. So our thanks to Jeffrey Nunberg. He's an adjunct full professor at the UC Berkeley School of Information and author of Ascent of the A-Word, A-holism, the First 60 Years. And now it's time for our question and answer period. And we've got a great set of questions. And I especially want to congratulate Jeff for getting through that entire talk without ever saying the whole word. It really is quite an art. So I think that's deserving of congratulations. So let me start with the first question to sort of combine some of your interests. And I'm going to mispronounce this like George Bush, I think. You'll probably stand up. Probably the best thing. So the first question is, are there various levels of a-holism? I once heard somebody referred to as a nuclear a-hole, for example. So you're just calling them one or the other. So what about the gradients?
You have a distinction. I can't remember the terminology now that you use between sort of congenital, born and dyed in the wool a-holes and occasional.
Temporary and permanent, sort of.
Permanent. The fact is that I think it's important to stress the temporary nature of this. That's why I talk about a-holism rather than just a-holes. That, you know, there is none of us who hasn't done this. I mean, please raise your hand if you have A, never behaved like an a-hole to somebody, and B, flown United Airlines in the last 10 years. I didn't think so. It's very difficult to go through life without behaving in that way. As Bob points out in his book, there are times when it's adaptive, when it's exactly the right sort of behavior. I remember I worked as a waiter once in a restaurant. This woman used to come in, and she terrified us all. And whatever she wanted, she got, because we didn't want to. So if you're willing to put up with the reactions you get, it can be a very effective strategy. But I think that... And I think we acknowledge this when we say so-and-so was being an a-hole. Right? We don't say so-and-so was being a narcissist. Right? That's you're in for a penny, in for a pound. You were being a real narcissist last night. If you were being a real narcissist last night, you've been a narcissist throughout. But being an a-hole is a quality you can have and not. And I think it's really important, and Bob has said this as well, too. I'd ask you to comment, but it's really important to recognize. One of the wonderful things about Bob's book is that he spends a lot of time talking about what an a-hole he was in certain situations.
Yeah, otherwise I would be lying, so it's true, yes.
Well, that hasn't stopped a lot of other people.
So let me ask the next question, because you did mention Ann Coulter's name, but mm-hmm. I noticed there was a disproportionate number of men, so let's dig into this. So basically, are a lot more men a-holes than women is the question?
Well, we certainly use the name more of men than of women, I mean, to a dramatic degree. And there are good reasons for that. A-holes tend to be people who confuse their who they are with what they do. In the organizational setting, this is a chronic problem. When you hear somebody saying, "Do you know who I am?" it's almost certain that he doesn't know either. In as much as leaders in organizations tend to a disproportionate amount, depending on the industry and so on and so forth, to be men. If leaders or managers are going to have this propensity, you're going to find it more among men. Men also tend to make that assumption that their role defines them in a way that women don't. But I also think that we do women an injustice in not using the A word of them.
It's like a form of sexism.
Well, I mean, a man that man who walks up to the airline counter and says, "Do you know how much money my company spends? Blah blah blah. Why didn't you give me an upgrade?" and so on and so forth. We think instantly, a-hole. A woman does the same thing. What do we think? We think no. We don't think a-hole. We think the B word. Yeah. Now, why would we think that? But what's the difference here? I mean, the B word says, "Oh, she's not doing it because she has the obtuse sense of entitlement that characterizes the a-hole. It's this primordial feminine malignity that makes her do it." So we're giving a very different explanation. There's no different explanation. A-holes are a-holes. If Eddie Fisher was an a-hole for leaving Debbie Reynolds, leaving Debbie Reynolds for Elizabeth Taylor, then what was Elizabeth Taylor for leaving Eddie Fisher for Mike Todd? Or Richard Burton, I think, was it. Why don't we use the word when it's appropriate for women as well? And I think the answer is that the B word introduces a gender linked notion that's not appropriate.
Well, that's an interesting feminist argument, I think. So I've got to make an announcement. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is noted linguist Jeffrey Nunberg, who's discussing the prevalence and prominence of one of America's most notable curse words, the A word. Okay, so I'm going to ask you about something that's in your book that you haven't discussed yet, which is one of the words that's kind of similar is calling somebody a narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference between a narcissist and an a-hole in your linguistic opinion?
Less than one supposes. One of the wonderful things I was able to do in this book was to use some of the databases that are available to trace the rising frequency of some of these words and to show how they correlate. It turns out that the a-hole, I said around 1970, introduced and becomes very frequent, independent of the increasing willingness of publishers to print it, that you can correct for that. Even then, it becomes much more frequent over the course of the rest of the century. And so does narcissist. And so does sense of entitlement. And so does inauthenticity. So does yuppie. So do a whole number of words that are connected to this particular worldview. Narcissist is a word that comes obviously from the psychoanalytic literature. It becomes popular around 1970. Before that, you only see it in psychoanalytic journals and so on. So by 1972, 1973, you're seeing it in Mademoiselle Horoscopes and places like that. And it really is just a fancy way of saying a-hole for the most part, but in a white coat, in clinical dress. When you see somebody described as a narcissistic a-hole, it's not like that's as opposed to a compulsive obsessive a-hole or something like that. It's just one of those empty modifiers, like the blithering between poor blithering idiot. It's not a kind of idiot, it's just an intensifier. So I think there's less, I mean, obviously they live in very different parts of the vocabulary, but they're actually quite similar.
You know, I got asked that exact same question in my first talk, and I answered it so badly that was actually beautiful. Let's sort of change topics to one that I've struggled with my whole life. I don't know the answer to. So how should someone react when you're treated as an a-hole? Is it okay to be an a-hole back? What's your sort of take on that?
And I think that's a complex. I quote Kant at the end on the complex, the moral complexities of it. He didn't quite use that word, but I think there are circumstances in which an uncivil action may appropriately be responded to with incivility. On the highway, for instance, it happens all the time. And, you know, maybe if you're a saint, you don't do it. But I think it's quite appropriate in lots of situations to do it. Where it becomes problematic in particular is in public life, when the temptation to respond to the a-holism of the other side. And this happens. Both the left and the right are guilty. The right tend to be better organized about it, but they both do it. I think that's the place in which you have to step back out of respect for the importance of the issues and refuse to respond.
So this is sort of a follow-up question, but you brought it up. But somebody asked whether driving is the worst manifestation of a-holism. Is that the worst place, or what's your sort
you know,
of opinion
it's
of that?
Interesting. They don't do surveys about this, but they do surveys about incivility, and you can read a lot about a-holism in those surveys. And people are asked, what are the most uncivil areas of American life? And at the bottom, the places that are least uncivil, the family dinner table, church, and so on. So school a little more so, but not that much, which is interesting because people are always saying it's the parents' fault. But, you know, if it was the parents' fault, you'd think it was all going on in the family. It's not. What they pick is driving. And then they pick these other impersonal or anonymous contexts, the Internet, political life, entertainment, the media. Those are the areas in which people see it. The complaints about driving go back to the first car. I mean, if you trace them back, yeah, people have been. Every generation says people are driving worse, and they've been saying that since 1904, right? And if it was true, there'd be nobody left alive. I mean, it is a situation in which you have lots of power. Somebody else has lots of power. They can be quite threatening. I mean, the risks of bad behavior on the highway are a lot greater than they are when you're walking down the street. You're anonymous, and you can do something to somebody that. My sense is that I tend to give the finger more to drivers who are going the other direction than ones who are going my direction, because I figure I won't see them.
That's an excellent test. I love that. So this is an interesting one. Actually, we were talking about this a little bit before we got up here, which is to what extent is the prevalence of the A word symbolic of the degradation of civility in America? Do other countries use this word as well?
Yeah. I mean, they don't use this word, but there are similar words that emerge around the same time. I wonder if we can say those words on American, you know, but there's the Italian, I'll say them, and then you decide whether to beep them for the Italian audience. The Italians say stronzo, which is a word that means, it's always something small and foul, not necessarily that, but which means turd. In Spanish, you say pendejo, which is pubic hair, and a lot of other words depending on your dialect. In France, there are words. The Germans use the same word we do. So the word, it isn't as if they're exact translations. But if you know what an a-hole is, you'll get stronzo right 90% of the time. So it isn't solely an American problem. And I think the other thing to bear in mind is that when you think about a-hole rather than civility, you realize that it's something we all do and sometimes feel not only permitted to do but justified in doing. And that it nonetheless counts as a form of incivility. So that the rise of incivility isn't a question of all these uncivil people out there whose parents haven't taken, you know, it's us. And it grows out of the roots of the culture. It isn't this little problem that can be solved by having national conversations and institutes and conferences and op-eds and so on and so forth, though that's what gets funded.
So just to shift gears slightly, and this calls on more of your expertise as a linguist, and you've talked about this in general or in specific for the word we're talking about, a-hole, but it's an interesting question. How does a new word go viral, which is to say, how does a word reach a tipping point where it enters the general lexicon?
It depends. Words like these, for example, couldn't possibly have been influenced by the media until the second half of the 20th century, because nobody ever used them in the media. I mean, you might see them in a book or in pornography or something, but, you know, you learn those words from the other guys in your unit. And words of that sort, even now, tend to rise up. They percolate up into the language. They don't drip down. Nowadays, the media have a much more decisive effect in that. And words correspondingly tend to, we get lots more new words. They have lots shorter half-lives. Mm. Because the media is looking, that was last week's word. You know, that's last year's word.
So given that, why has a-hole lasted so long? Because the first 60 years, that's your subtitle.
Well, I think you do see all these, there's a D word and ending in bag and a this and a that. Uh-huh. I see lots of variants of it. But I think certain words are anchored by now in the culture.
Okay.
and have an abiding use.
So this actually, while we're on words, this is an interesting word because you do talk about it in the book. So please talk about the word entitlement in its political relevance today, because that it really is one of those sort of words that's related to the A word, but it's got a little different.
Yeah, no, it's it also is connected. I actually did a Fresh Air piece on this yesterday, and it's complicated because it has these political and psychological meanings that are way far apart, but that kind of influence each other. So, let me just rant about a political point. An entitlement is a government benefit established by statute and not subject to budgetary discretion. Could be Social Security, could be Medicare, could be crop subsidy, right? They're all just entitlements in a legal sense. Owing to the rise of entitlement in this psychological sense, people now think of them as things to which people are entitled or feel entitled or should feel entitled or don't legitimately feel entitled, and that psychology colors the way this word is used, where it should be just thought of in a technical way. The other sense, the psychological sense, comes in also in the early 70s, sense of entitlement along with the A word. It's first introduced in the mid 60s in this sense by psychiatrists who make it a diagnostic for narcissism. Mm. By the early 70s, a sense of entitlement has in popular usage, by the late 70s, I should say, only a negative sense. So if you say so-and-so has a sense of entitlement, the implication is it's unjustified, it's false, they don't genuinely deserve what they're having. And it becomes another way of saying narcissist. Now, you could say, you could say, well, it's just people have always complained about kids being spoiled. And right. That's true, and this repeats a lot. I mean, every generation, no, there's never been a generation that wasn't disappointed with the one coming up. That's human nature. But entitled and spoiled really are slightly different. Entitled has the sound of a clinical judgment. Spoiled, you ask your grandma. You know, entitled, you ask Dr. Joyce. A spoiled just implies a kind of infantile wish, where entitled implies a claim to a right or so. So I mean, you and I both know that when you right. give a spoiled kid a B-
oh, yes.
on his final, he comes in during office hours and he throws a fit about how he's not going to get into medical school and his family's going, so on and so forth. You give the same grade to a kid who's got a sense of entitlement, and you get a call from his family lawyer, right?
Right. Yeah. At Stanford, we get them from the ones who get the A-.
Right.
So I went to Cal, so I know the difference. They had tougher grades at Cal, at least when I went there. So this one is one that we've both thought about a little bit. It's about different professions. So what profession sort of has the most A-holes in it, and which ones have the least? What's your sort of sense of that?
Boy, you would have a better sense than I. I mean, this is a territory that you have mapped in some
detail. Yeah, and so nauseating me too.
And ask you, what do you think?
I think surgeons. If I was going to, I used to think it was lawyers. I'm married to a lawyer, with all due respect to lawyers out there. But I actually just got an email today from a woman who's a surgeon, and she's running a search for residents, and she's trying to find one who isn't an a-hole and is having trouble and is competent. So that actually made me sort of nervous. Probably the most abused profession is probably nurses, ironically, because they're on the receiving end, and they get it from patients, they get it from their bosses, they get it from everybody. So I guess that would be my sense. In terms of the least, I would have to pick nuns, actually. Mm. I mean, there's occasionally one who's really tough, but I'm really, even though I'm not Catholic, I'm Jewish, but I'm really into nuns these days because they're really tough. But that would sort of be my occupation of choice that has the least. I guess those are both female-dominated professions. So speaking of which,
I was going to add about sir, I did a radio piece some years ago, and I got a call in my office from the secretary for a surgeon in Palo Alto. And she said, Dr. So-and-so heard your piece and would like to ask you a question or two about it. Would you be willing to do that? And I said, sure. And she said, just a moment, I'll put you on hold.
Perfect. I gave a talk before while we're telling stories, an a-hole talk in Stanford. It was actually the alums, and I actually had a fight between two surgeons and three nurses about what jerks they were, and the surgeons were arguing that it was necessary because the nurses were so incompetent. The whole room blew up. Anyways, so speaking of which, so I'm going to ask you the question that you turned back at me. So are you an a-hole? So this is like, so what's your sort of take on this?
Well, you have to ask my wife for
oh, yeah, the wives, they know everything.
Frequently. Can I say that? And yeah. I think it's important to put it that way rather than just say chronically.
Chronically,
whatever.
Yes.
Because, I mean, other people say he's chronically. But the point is, if you're chronically an a-hole, that's it. You know, it's like being left-handed. You know?
Where Donald Trump, as you
frequently
pointed out,
is something you can do something about. There are people around. I think the interesting thing about being an a-hole is you're not aware of it at the time. You're so angry or so into your self-delusions or so puffed up that you just... And then afterwards you say, oh, boy, I was really being an a-hole. There are people out there. I was actually on a radio program this morning, a video program this morning with one of them, this guy who writes these books and who proudly proclaim to be a-holes. A-holes finish first was the
name
of the book this guy wrote, and make a whole fuss about it and take Steve Jobs or whatever, Bobby Knight as their life model. And my sense is that they don't get it. If you... hear somebody who's proudly proclaiming that he's an a-hole. He's not an a-hole. He's a dick.
Well, that was... I love
it. It's one of the things.
There's a line in the book that is so good. That I actually almost read it, but I had a short introduction, so now I can say it, which is that you're talking about Donald Trump, who really is one of my least favorite people on earth, to be honest. But you had this line, which I've been thinking about for days, which is that he's an a-hole, so we don't have to be. So you, like, dig into that phenomenon a little? Because you're like a whole, like... paragraph that went on to this phenomenon.
Well, there's obviously a vicarious pleasure in watching people, as I say, be a-holes, particularly to people who maybe just be a-holes. I mean, Charlie Sheen is just out there doing it. To people in these set-up reality shows, to people who have demonstrated that they are a-holes, The Apprentice. And there's a kind of, you could say, a kind of cathartic pleasure in watching that, and I think that's certainly the appeal of O'Reilly and other people, you know, and people on the left as well. That they're jerks. I mean, whether O'Reilly's really a jerk or not, I don't know. I have my suspicions, but I don't know. But people do not go turn into O'Reilly or Limbaugh or Keith Olbermann to hear them being gentle and solicitous of their guests and exchange reasoned civil positions on the issues. That, you know, that's not how you get to have 12 million daily listeners.
So it's interesting because, I mean, you're talking about the attractiveness of it, but there's something that you talk about a bit in the book, but it's something that's also always intrigued me, which is that, so you're just generally saying some people are and some people aren't, and sometimes they act like this. Mm-hmm. But so, in your opinion, what's the difference between an effect, like one who's an effective a-hole and an ineffective? So, have you thought about like what are some of the distinguishing characteristics? Because clearly, I mean, some of these
people.
You mean
in a leadership?
And almost any part of life. But we could start with leadership if you wanted to. But it's even like you know, somebody cuts in front of you in line, and what's the effective response? But leaders are another interesting case.
No, and cutting in front. I mean, the interesting thing, the research on that, as I'm sure you know. Shows that often that kind of behavior is not only more effective for you, but more effective generally.
Right.
If a certain number of people behave like that, traffic moves faster and the line moves better and so on and so forth. Although they, I think something you said in your book, and I quote this passage actually, so I'm going to throw it back at you. I wrote about Steve Jobs, whom I think is an interesting character because his a-holism isn't the kind of pure rich guy a-holism of a character like Larry Ellison. I mean, he really was more like, you know, one of the drummers for Metallica, right? He's kind of a rock star. I mean, he did things that were goofy things that had nothing to firing people in the middle of a public meeting. I know somebody, I mentioned this, who says at least that he quit his rather responsible position at Apple just because he got tired of wiping Jobs' spittle off his glasses. And you mentioned that this is problematic. Some people take a character like Jobs as a lesson. Look, here's this guy. He's right. A consummate a-hole, and look, he became Steve Jobs. Isaacson, in his biography, says, no, that's not it. In fact, that was an impediment to his getting his job, but he was so good at other parts of it that he meant. So I'm going to just throw that at you and ask
well,
you.
Well, I mean, the Jobs case is – I'll comment on Jobs, but I have sort of two theories about Jobs. Mm-hmm. One is my sort of – really, I'm true belief about Jobs in all cases is he was such a strong, complex character that he's like a Rorschach test, that everybody just looks at them and they take whatever they want, the good and the bad qualities, and I that's sort of where I'm at with Steve Jobs. And what led me to this, by the way, was first I gave a talk to 40 Chinese executives with simultaneous translation. I couldn't understand the word they were saying, and it ended with them all screaming at each other about whether Steve was a jerk or not and whether or not it was functional. And then I went to a party where I was talking to three people who worked with him for 10 years, and they had the exact same argument. So you had as much knowledge or as little knowledge, and they ended up in the same place. But the other thing, which is interesting, and it's just interesting you mentioned Isaacson, and I met Isaacson recently, and he emphasized this even more than in the book. And then I also know two people. So the whole Jobs universe, everybody's so paranoid of getting in trouble and naming who they are, but these are two people who knew him extremely well. And they, all three of them say the same thing. He was such a great person, if only he was just a little more civilized. He would, so people who knew him closely, except for the people at Pixar who love him. So that's sort of my sense on Jobs. But he's such a complicated character. Okay, so let's move on to something a little bit different and go back to the linguistic stuff. And this is something you talked about, but it's something that even I guess I would challenge you on as well. So this notion of, you talk about it in almost like an objective way. But so is it possible that, is it possible for one person's sort of a-hole to be the other person's objective sort of passionate crusader who's really a great person? So how do you?
Sure. The short answer is sure.
Uh-huh.
What's remarkable though is given how subjective the category is,
uh-huh.
given how likely it is to alter according to whether we think what the person's trying to do is laudable or not, how much intersubjective agreement there is about the category. So when you look at Trump, who is also sui generis, and I talk about him and Jobs, everybody thinks Trump is an idiot. You know, when you looked online, when Trump was actually for a brief period leading the polls among Republicans for the Republican nomination. Talk about that. Nobody denied that he was an a-hole. They said, yeah, he's an a-hole, but he's the one who'll bring it home and tell people what Obama's really doing, or we need an a-hole now, or what, or a jerk, or what. And so nobody was deluded about his a-holism. But people felt that, you know, this was a situation in which that was exactly what you wanted, was an a-hole like that. So that can be the other way as it goes, that people don't disagree about whether somebody's an a-hole, but disagree as to whether it's acceptable in that circumstance.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, so this brings me to another linguistic word, and one of the questions sort of implied this, but since, like, you keep track of all these different words, if you were going to sort of come up with a contender for two or three words or that we're going to actually replace it, since, you know, 60 years is a long time, but there's always contenders in language. Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of the contenders?
That D word that I won't allow myself to say again is out there and has swollen enormously in usage in recent years. The other D word, the D-O-U word, has also been used more frequently. It's very hard to know. It depends in part on how this works out socially. I mean, there are lots of groups using the language, kids, adolescents of different races, ethnic backgrounds, and so on and so forth. This language kind of lives among those groups. That's where it bubbles up from. I mean, these are not words that you learn when you're 36,
right.
You got your PhD. They're words you master when you're 13. And that's, by the way, why it's always weird to hear a foreigner, even a foreigner who speaks English so well, using these words. I think he's such an, you know, because, you know, nobody ever washed his mouth out with soap for saying those very syllables. It's hard to know. And I think it depends, because this word is, as I say, so connected to so many social developments. You'd have to tell that whole story to know where it's going. So I can't tell you.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's funny how early the words get learned. I remember, my daughters are grown now, but when my 5-year-old daughter was teaching my 3-year-old daughter how to say, well, the S word we have to say because of the radio. And so it was Claire saying to Eve, Claire's the older one, which is, okay, say S, they're right in front of my study, say S. No, you got to stomp your feet and you got to look really mad. So she was like teaching her. So this is like, it was so cute. Like, I couldn't really stop them. I knew they're going to learn it anyways. Mm-hmm. But
that's
it was
wonderful.
The
that's
whole performance
story, yeah.
and they both say it very well now, of course, and have for many years.
Let me just, one point that brings home, which I think is important to stress, is that these words, the reason that a word like a-hole could move from its literal meaning to this figurative meaning in which it retained its force, even though it's no longer referring, and no longer has anything to do with what it originally referred to, is that these words are like magic spells. The magic inheres in the syllables themselves. That's why you can just put an asterisk in, and all of a sudden it's okay, because a spell doesn't work unless you say it just right, and just taking one letter out makes it inefficacious. And it's the lesson that kids learn long before they've learned any of these words, when, for example, they take this pleasure in saying shampoo, right? Because it's got that magic syllable in it, and it's a license to say the magic syllable. But at the point at which the child says shampoo and giggles, he or she has learned everything he or she has to know about this kind of language.
So let me, related to that, and this, you actually did talk about this on Fresh Air, but I thought that it was quite fascinating. So we're talking about one specific obscenity, and one of the things that I've got a lot of, and I'm sure you'll get a lot of, which is essentially, why do we have to talk this way? I mean, it's more of a general question, like is there any getting rid of vulgarity or swearing, or do we just need it?
I think we need it. I mean,
what do we need it for?
We there's certain kinds of indignation that require this kind of language for their expression. Because what do you say when you use a word like this? If the words have to be forbidden, like that child learned about poop, they have to be forbidden. And then you have to be in a situation where you can say, I am so angry that my anger is overcoming my inhibitions. This word is just escaping. Or you are so contemptible that you're not worthy of obeying the intuitions the inhibitions that normally govern our polite conversation. So I'm going to use this word of you because you don't deserve that. Well, those moves are basic moves, and they're basic ways of demonstrating, and I say demonstrating, contempt, and not just expressing it. When you swear at somebody, you're not just saying I don't like you. You're demonstrating your contempt for them, and that's because these are forbidden words that you are nonetheless allowing yourself to express.
So we're getting towards the end of our program, and maybe I'll sort of just end with a question, which I don't think I've ever been asked, so I'm going to subject it to you. So we sort of like imply that, you know, these people who are jerks are sort of unlikable, but you kind of imply some are likable too. So who are some of your favorite a-holes and why? Is that sort of a closing comment?
Yeah, that's it too. Now I'm stumped. I'm thinking about now who I put on the cover of the book. There are shamanic. Well, okay, there's a style of a-hole.
Okay.
Right? Gore Vidal, the late lamented Gore Vidal, was a colossal a-hole, but played it so well and with such brio, and played it in such a way as to make certain points and to deflate certain. So was Mailer.
Norman Mailer was, so charming and despicable all at the same time.
And could be just an awful person, but it was an awful person in a very artful way. So I think there are certainly literary a-holes. Ezra Pound would certainly qualify.
Well, what about politicians? Are there any ones who qualify, or are they just all simply despicable?
No, I think there have been politicians. I mean, Johnson, if you read Carroll's biography, certainly was capable of that and was capable of just doing horrible things, but also was capable of doing horrible things in the context of trying to get something good done. So I think there are complex figures like that, both in political life and literary.
I actually think that that's quite interesting because the ones who end up being, I think, most lovable a lot of times are the ones. Johnson's perfect. If you read Johnson, he was brilliant and terrible. Had that ability to turn it on and off, and that's what the Jobsian thing that he had. I mean, the people who loved him the most were probably David Pogue and Mossberg, who are the reviewers for Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, because they had to love him because it was so good for the Apple products. And there are other people, like in human resources at Apple. He described them once as being like barnacles on ships. They just slow you down. Mm-hmm. They call themselves barnacles in HR at Apple very often. It's that ability to sort of charm you and just smash you that does it. So I like the ones that you pick. Any other politicians before we wrap up?
A politician whose asshole was my...
That's pretty good. You made it this far.
The whole thing. Whose a-hole is my admire. They could just... It's radio, so they can just... I want to think about. I think there are plenty, it's not coming to me.
It's hard to beat Johnson. Actually, he was like.
Yeah, no. Johnson was an extraordinary character. I mean, FDR could be an a-hole of colossal proportions. And then there are artists. Bernini, for instance. I just read a wonderful biography of Bernini. Up there.
I think of Maggie Thatcher too. She was sort of like that. Yeah. Okay, so I think it's time to wrap up. So a round of applause. Our thanks for Jeff Nunberg.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much. For radio, I've got to say, he's an adjunct full professor at UC Berkeley School of Information, again, a great school, author of Ascent of the A-Word, A-Holism, the First 60 Years. We'd like to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. And I'm Professor Robert Sutton from Stanford University. And we've got to do this. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. This is the funnest part. Thank you very much.